Welcome back to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. We have an awesome show for you this week. A lot to get to. Road test editor Zach Palmer went to the Indy 500 and he got to drive some things on the track. I've been driving the electric Nissan Ariya. They're all electric, of course, but I got to drive the eForce, which is kind of cool. Also, we're going to spend your money. This is a good one. Somebody is going to buy their dream car for $60,000. We're going to help them out. So with that, let's get right into it. Zach, you're just back from Indy. What's going on, man?
Yeah, man, this was my first Indy 500. I cannot tell you how psyched I was to be able to go there. You know me well enough that I'm like a Formula One guy through and through. But Indy is a special place. It's called the greatest spectacle in racing for a reason. Mm-hmm. Having attended my first one, I think that I am likely to agree with that statement. It is otherworldly. I'd say like the most impactful thing for me was when we got to do the grid walk before the race and whatnot.
Yeah.
And I got to go down there, be at track level, and walk to the front of the grid and just stare at that first corner. And, you know, you see it on TV and whatnot, and, you know, it looks like a tight corner. It looks like you're really hanging a left there. But to see it in person and to know that they're, like, heading into this corner at 220, 230 miles per hour is just mind-bending because it is a left turn. Like you're not, it's not an oval. Sure, maybe it looks like an oval from above and whatnot, but this is a hard left turn that they're just barreling into inches away from each other, side by side, three wide, whatever, into this corner. And to just see that, I mean, you gain so much more respect for what these drivers are doing. And then of course you actually see them go do it minutes afterwards and whatnot. I thought it was a really great race. I don't know if you watched it, but it was a lot of fun being there. There's certainly a lot of controversy just right at the end with like three red flags right in a row. Like the race was just generally like for the first 120 laps or so, it was a little dreary and whatnot. Like there wasn't much happening. You know, that was sort of to be expected. Honda had I was there with Honda, and Honda had a couple of their drivers roll in to their booth to just sort of chat about the race beforehand. And what they were sort of expecting was everybody to be, you know, pretty tactical with their moves at the first half of the race, you know, everybody be pretty conservative because Indy 500 is a long race. It's 500 miles. So a big key to actually winning it is to just get through it because the speedway is so dangerous and it's so easy to crash. You have to be just inch perfect. So people were pretty conservative. And then as you know, you start going later and later, they'll really pull their, punching bags and, you know, get their fists out and start going at it. You could really tell that was happening down to the last like 30, 40 laps because of those red flags. And I know there's definitely been some discourse online about that, the final red flag, creating like a, sort of one lap shootout to the finish. You can tell that, you know, it's hectic and it can get dangerous. You know, there've been a lot of really scary crashes at Indy, and to, you know, to send everybody out there with one lap to just absolutely duel it out. It was wild to see. I mean, to watch, both Ericsson and Newgarden, obviously Newgarden ended up winning the race, but to watch them weave back and forth, like all across the track through that whole final lap was just, it was mesmerizing and it was scary and it was wild. At one point, they were both like aiming down pit lane, 220 miles per hour plus, just trying to break each other's toe. And I was out there in the grandstands watching them roll down to the finish line, you know, just less than a car length apart. It was a lot to take in. It really, really was. It's unlike anything that I've seen. I've been to F1 races and a bunch of Indy, like actual road course races. But watching those cars go around that track was something special. And I know that I'm definitely going to be back. And if you do go, like the people watching is also otherworldly. Like the crowd there, 320,000 people, which is more than any other sporting events in the world for any one day event. It's crazy. Like you can't see the whole track, wherever you sit at, no matter how high you sit, you seem to not be able to see everything. But what you can see from one side to the other, just packed full of people, like every seat taken. I think it sort of speaks a little bit to the resurgence of motorsports in the U.S. I mean, the Indy 500 has always been popular, but it has really taken on, you know, a new level of mass popularity, I feel, as more people are getting the F1, more people get into Indy, more people just interested in racing. So that was super great to see too. And I'll just sort of wrap it up. Like there was that one super scary moment. I don't know if you saw that tire fly off the car.
That was crazy, man. 250 feet or yards, however far it flew. That was crazy.
Yeah. So like I was there and I was in the grandstands, and so you can't really see the TV really well. So like I was just like blown away by, oh my God, this car is upside down, blah, blah, blah. And then I like roll back down into the, our general watching area where I have some TV screens to see it. And I like everybody is just like face solemn, like, oh my God, what just happened? I was like, okay, yeah, like he's safe, whatever. But then I saw the replay and I saw the tire fly off and go flying over top of the grandstands. And yeah, that was a really scary moment because there was for like a few minutes we were like, oh my God, did that hit somebody? You know, if it did hit somebody, you know, there's a good chance that, you know, that could have killed someone. Could have been really, really bad. And I just never, ever seen a tire go flying off into the stands like that in modern motorsports. So I have a feeling that that's something that other people are going to be looking at as the months and years go on. Like, how do we avoid a situation like that? Thankfully, it hit a Chevy Cruze. It totaled the Cruze, sounds like. The IndyCar president looks like gave the owner of the Cruze a ride home from the event, and she got to kiss the bricks. So it had a pretty happy ending to it, but man, that was scary. Overall, great weekend though. Highly recommend if you haven't been to the 500, get to one because it's a special event to see.
Yeah, it's one of the great venues in all of sports. I would compare it perhaps almost to a baseball stadium, Fenway Park, which I was fortunate to get to 7-8 years ago. So much with the history, but also just the aesthetics, that double-decked grandstand. They're both built around the same time, 1910, somewhere in there. And you feel the history dripping from every corner of the place, and it's, you know, the fans are right on top of the track in certain parts of it, and to me that is so cool. It's like you, I got to do that kind of pre-race walk the last time I went, which was I think it was actually 2016 or 17, somewhere in there, probably 16, no 17, I don't know. But I mean, you're down there, it's so like, and it's also a little bit calmer at that point too, because usually when they let, you know, the race, the drivers obviously, but like celebrities, press, whoever happens to be there, do it, it's kind of a cerebral time. So yeah, I mean, it's just, it's really a magical place. And you know, I got to do like sort of ride along hot laps in a Chevy SS with one of the Chevy like engineering drivers, I think. And just like going through that corner that you mentioned, you know, it was really early in the morning. It was just such a dramatic moment, you know, and of course I had eaten a bunch of like, I think San Elmo's steak or something the night before and shrimp. So it's a great way to not feel great, but, yeah, it's a really cool place. And, you know, the tire incident, like you said, that's wild. I haven't seen anything in motorsports like that since like, I think they said it was either the 80s or the 90s is the last time something like this happened. Either way, it's been a long time or a really long time. And Roger Penske said the tires are all allegedly tethered to the car. But I mean, clearly, literally something went sideways, went wrong. But kind of weird.
Yeah. I mean, sure. I guess you can tether them to the car, but it is, I'm not sure if we're capable of making tethers that are going to hold a tire on when it gets absolutely smacked going like 200 miles an hour. I mean, maybe where we are, maybe something had been weakened from the crash itself, and that was why. But yeah, that was a wild moment.
Yeah. I wonder if I'm surprised it doesn't happen more often, you know, given the laws of physics, if you will.
Yeah.
So. All right. So that's the Indy 500. You know, if you've already, you know, you probably at this point know that Newgarden won and, you know, most of the details of the tire and some of the surrounding things. If you want to dive back into it, we have a really nice piece written by one of our freelancers, Kirby Arnold. He was actually a sports writer for a long time with the Seattle Times. He was one of managing editor Greg Race's colleagues. He did a great story on the daily drivers of IndyCar racers. So check it out. People drive all sorts of different things, as you would imagine. It's timeless. You know, it isn't really related to the 500 at this point, but I would refer you back to the site if you want to just kind of check out a pretty cool feature. Came out really well. One of our top trafficked stories of the week, which I think tells you something, because IndyCar and Formula One, as much as we like it, still tends to be pretty niche on the internet. Growing, but somewhat niche. It never breaks through the Tesla, you know, Florida Man, Ferrari, Ford Bronco. Like, you all know the hits, if you will, of traffic, internet traffic. But last week it did. So it was good to see.
It's heartening to hear, honestly. I love it.
Yeah. So speaking of Tesla, in a very odd, this is one of the more bizarre things I've watched. I think you were already on your way to Indy at this point. It was a Twitter spaces, live spaces, whatever they call it. And about half an hour, we'll say, before it happened, Jim Farley, the Ford CEO, tweets out, "Hey, I'm doing a Twitter spaces with none other than Elon Musk," who one day earlier had basically broke the internet, or maybe the internet broke it, I don't know, with the presidential announcement of Ron DeSantis. So the fact that the Ford CEO was doing this a day later was a little surreal. I think they had a more scaled back approach. It was just like audio only. They did take some questions from a Tesla investor, that type of thing. But the crux of it is Ford customers get access to Tesla superchargers, which is, I think, it's good for Ford customers, you know, and it's a revenue stream for Tesla. So theoretically, it's a win-win. I do kind of wonder, and it's a win-win, I think, for the electric vehicle, just like game industry, such as it is, because more people get more access to better, good, top quality chargers. I don't totally think Tesla had to do this, but it's interesting that they're willing to kind of be like, you know, frenemies with Ford. And it was, you know, Jim Farley hosts a podcast on Spotify. It's pretty good, actually, every now and then. Well, it's good, but he doesn't host it all the time, or it doesn't happen all the time. Let's put it that way. So there was a bit of a rapport between them. And, you know, it feels kind of like a win for Ford and kind of like an okay thing for Tesla. You know, how do you feel about this?
Man, the craziest part of this news was the fact that Ford is going to start like using the Tesla charge port in 2025, they said.
You can buy an adapter before then.
Yeah, you can get an adapter before then, but like there will be Ford vehicles just manufactured with the Tesla actual charger port, which I feel like, you know, that's a thing that OEMs have resisted probably for a long, long time at this point, because they're like, all right, you know, we're going to go do CCS. This is going to be our thing. And we've built out a massive charging infrastructure with CCS in mind. Is that charging infrastructure very good? In my experience and most of our experiences, no, it's rather unreliable and troublesome. So this is maybe sort of an admission from Ford that this, you know, was maybe a bit of a mistake, and we're going to go, you know, use the charging network that is actually super reliable and everywhere and seamless to use. So, I mean, it's really tough to dissect this and actually come to a conclusion, because it's going to, you know, it's going to happen in 2 years. The US government is paying like untold sums of money to get like CCS charging up and going for all other EVs other than Tesla. Like, where is this actually going to shake out 4 to 5 years from now? Like, will we be happy that Ford's have the Tesla connector, Will we be like a little, you know, upset that it doesn't have both options or that it doesn't have CCS? I feel like it just raises a lot of questions, and we're not really going to know the answers to them for another couple few years here. But Ford is the first one to, you know, sort of jump the shark here and just, all right, hey, we got the Tesla charging network here. We're going to go for it. We're going to do it. Cause they're going to have to engineer it into their cars, and there's sort of no going back once they start down that path. So I was shocked, just like you'd hear the news that they were even doing this Twitter Spaces, and then even more shocked at the news itself that came out of it. So yeah, wild times for Ford EVs. I guess I'll be curious in the immediate future. I'll be curious to see if other EV makers decide to go the same way. I don't know if they're chatting with the U.S. government about that. Like, hey guys, we're spending billions of dollars to build out this EV charging network for these cars that we're no longer making, that no longer fit these chargers. Right. There will be adapters, and you know, you'll be able to ultimately make it work. It's just a lot of, you know, very early days time of EVs, a lot of things happening.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's confusing. And the nuance, the adapter is interesting. In some ways, the cars right now that you could get the adapter for, they didn't exactly spell out how this will work. Like, no, to your point, there's a lot of questions. Does this mean my like 2023 Mach-E or Lightning, I can charge at like a CCS and a supercharger? Just I pull the adapter off and on? I don't know what the adapter physically is going to look like either. How that module, you know, will work. Will it be like the dealer installs it and then that's it? Or is it like something you kind of put in? I wouldn't think so, right? Because it's like an electrical socket, you know?
No. So like what Teslas do right now, actually, like they can charge at like an Electrify America or like an EVgo. Yeah. Tesla sells an adapter that you can, that you can connect and then charge there. I don't know about the actual charge speed and what they're able to accomplish on those ones, but
that's a great question too.
You can do it. I mean, I've seen Model Ys, Model 3s chilling at Electrify America's charging away. I don't know why they would do it, because it's very expensive and unreliable versus a lot of superchargers, but you can do it if you need to in a cinch. And I suspect that that's what will happen in the future with Fords too. Like, you will be able to do it. The question is whether you'll want to do it or not. So
that's a great question too, because ultimately I think for most people to, you know, for the process of speeding EV adoption with mainstream consumers is they don't want to have to think about it. You know, we could get to this in a minute here, but I had the Ariya eForce, that's Nissan's, you know, crossover EV, like 200 plus, 220, 30, 40 miles of range, beautiful crossover. And I went to a, you know, charge point this weekend trying to charge up, and just one of the chargers just wouldn't work. And I'm just like, well, this sucks. You know, it did. It got the message of, oh, let's see, what's the message? A waiting EV. And if you've ever used one of those places, you've gotten that once or twice. And like the forums, Reddit, etc., seemed to think it was basically a bad handshake between the car and the charger, which, you know, it sounds like that's more on the charger than it is on the car. That's what most users seem to think. So, I mean, that was frustrating. And I mean, to me, if you're adding different kinds of chargers, like that's, you know, different adapters, could be a good thing, might not, you know, because then you're going to be at the point, well, like, okay, I'm here, I've got the adapter, oh crud, it doesn't charge well, or it doesn't work, you know. You're definitely bringing in a lot of layers there. And if you install a charger at your home, you're good. That eliminates a lot of the challenges, you know. I mean, I went on Memorial Day, I went over to my brother's place, other side of town. We ended up taking the family GMC Acadia because the night before, I went to charge the Ariya, and again, it wouldn't work. Didn't have time to like mess around. So he's kind of limped home driving slowly. And then the next morning I went to charge it. And, you know, I still didn't get that much because it was funny. The fleet called me and they're like, hey, we're coming for the car. And I'm like, I'm at charge point. They're like, okay, it's all good. But if you do, like, if you're going to be an EV owner, you've really got to be ready to plan ahead, roll with unexpected problems. And it's probably better if you get something at home too, like, you know, a level two charger, just because then you never have to worry about getting too low. And that's not like, I think that's just a pretty accurate assessment of what's going on. I think a lot of people right now are coming at this from both sides really, really hot. And, you know, I've been driving a lot of EVs lately, and that's kind of the conclusion I've come to is, you know, I don't have a charger at home, so it's tricky when I rely on the grid, which I like doing. I really like going to these different places, trying things out. It's like a mini Cars and Coffee. I was hanging out with this guy with a Polestar 2, you know, and I saw some lady in an Audi, I forget what it was, one of the e-tron crossover things. It's a fun experience, but a lot of challenges. And, you know, we'll see how this works out for Ford and Tesla.
Yeah, it's a great illustration of why EVs are good for people that have a level two charger with a home place they can park it at, and why it's a big struggle for people still that might live in an apartment or live in some sort of condo situation, you know, where they can't plug in overnight and constantly have it. Because I too, just like you had your night blown up, your day, like that you were going to take this car, like I've spent an hour and a half trundling from one charger to another across town trying to get one of them to work because I don't have a level two charger at home. You know, if I did, I'd just plug that thing up and you know, it'd be good to go by morning. But it's really like EVs, you know, they make sense for some people's lifestyles now, but not necessarily for everybody else's. And to sort of bring this back to Ford, like one of the last questions that I had for him here is like, one of the biggest advantages I feel with the Tesla supercharger system is how like baked in and sort of closed off their ecosystem is, in that like you can set a waypoint in your nav and it will navigate you to all of the Tesla superchargers to have X amount percentage of charge left, you know, by the time you get there. Ford's kind of done their own thing. They've tried to do some navigational stuff through their navigation with like Electrify America and EVgos and whatnot. But are they going to be able to tie into the Tesla supercharger network and offer that same experience? Or is it going to be a little clunky? That's a question I feel like we still need to answer, because sure, the fact that the chargers are there is great and all, but you needed to be able to make it seamless for a customer, like a Tesla is seamless for somebody to road trip and to do this without having to download apps and think five steps ahead. Cause that's the reality right now. We'll see, I guess three 4 years from now.
One thing that I thought was interesting, and this is where Jim Farley's like podcast hosting expertise came in. He just literally asked Elon Musk where the hell the Roadster is. I was like, wow.
Good on him. I love it.
Four-seam fastball. Way to go, Jim. Like, Tesla doesn't have a PR department or not much of one, and he doesn't really take a lot of questions from mainstream journalists. But hey, Ford's main man, you know, throws a hard one at you, and he answered. He said, I think the design will be locked in this year, and then next year, allegedly, it'll be out, which I'm excited about the Roadster. I always liked it. It was a Lotus, so what's not to like? It's an electric Lotus. What's wrong with that, right? So I'll be interested to see what their take is on that. So,
I think we're coming up on like 5 or 6 years since it was revealed.
Right. I don't know, flip a coin. What gets here first, the Cybertruck or the Roadster?
Maybe neither. I don't know.
Neither. Yeah, the semi maybe. All right, so let's move on. This is a good segue just over to the Ariya, which I enjoyed immensely. I drove it last fall at North American Car, Truck, and SUV of the Year testing. And I, you know, it was one of many different sort of crossover SUV electric things there that I will admit it kind of got lost in the shuffle a little bit. It had been out for a little bit. It did not have the sizzle of the Kia EV6, which did win crossover of the year. I think deservedly so too. or even the Cadillac Lyric. It was, I don't know, but this one, second stint in it, spent a lot of time in it, and I really, really liked it. Outside of that charging hiccup, which wasn't the car's fault. That was the charging. That was the grid's fault. But, you know, it's, I would recommend this as an option for somebody who's looking for, like, a mainstream crossover, you know, that's electric. It has an interesting design, but it's not too futuristic. It's almost kind of it's very curvy. Let's put it that way. And it's got nice proportions and it has a nice interior. It's fairly priced. This one is $62,770, which sounds like a lot for a Nissan crossover. But again, this is, you know, electric and it's platinum. And this is the E-Force. I don't know if there's a special way to pronounce it, but
that is it. It's loaded. That's how you do it. E-Force.
Yeah, E-Force. So, you know, it's all-wheel drive and it's fun to drive. And it's great visibility. It feels sporty-ish, sportier than, say, the Volkswagen ID4. And I think, you know, Ford is really trying to get a lot of electric, you know, new electric buyers by going with like Mustang and Lightning. But that's also too somewhat like, I mean, Lightning sells a ton of, or F-150 sells a ton of volume. But Mustang, even though it's a crossover, it's not going to be for everybody, you know? And I think you get things like the ID4, the Ariya, you know, things coming out like the Polestar 3, which is a little more expensive. You know, this is where you're going to start to really hit a huge part of the market of people who just want like a crossover that's electric. And I was really impressed with it. I put a ton of stuff in it, a lot of groceries, a lot of golf clubs, because I played 27 holes of golf the other weekend, 18 one day and 9 the next. So that's
hell yeah.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was fun. Back was feeling a little tired, but yeah, I really like this car, and it came in a color called Passion Red Tricoat, which, you know, it sounds superficial, but the car I drove at NACTOY was like not that exciting for whatever reason. Maybe it was red, but it didn't stick out in my head. But driving a loaded up one in Passion Red, it gets your attention, which, like I said, that could be superficial, but hey, you have my attention now. And then I really dug into it and was dialed into the different things that I liked and didn't like. Interior, I didn't love. Like, you could adjust the center console. Cool, whatever, fun party trick. Infotainment, not great. It was fine. It had a very nice kind of like haptic touch thing going across the, like, this kind of wood like panel that bisected the dash. But yeah, it was good. You know, it did have like you mentioned earlier, certain EVs will tell you like what's on the grid, what's nearby. So it was very helpful in that sense, even though I kind of know where most of the chargers are in my neighborhood. But I liked it a lot. It was a good refresher for me. Have you driven the Ariya yet?
I have not.
No. The Ariya. I don't know if I'm saying this right.
Ariya. I have a feeling that a lot of people that go to buy it they're not going to know how to pronounce it. It's going to be said a million different ways. I think that Nissan, I've heard some Nissan people say Ariya before.
I think it's Ariya.
So yeah. I'm pretty sure that that's the way to pronounce it, but
yeah,
it'll probably be pronounced that way approximately 10 to 15% of the time.
Yeah. Well, it's like the Chevy Traverse, like a bunch of Michigan-based journalists were calling it the Chevy Traverse for a long time. Whoops.
It's the Traverse City Edition Traverse.
Right.
But I have not driven the Ariya.
Okay.
The closest to driving one is, man, probably about 3 or 4 years ago. Nissan did a prototype of their E-Force all-wheel drive system in a Nissan Leaf, where they threw exactly. Like they're like, all right, so this is our all-wheel drive. This is our electric all-wheel drive system that we're going to put in all of our upcoming EVs called E-Force. It had a true like torque vectoring on the rear axle, which this Ariya has. And it was actually really fun to drive, which was exactly what you were saying, is, you know, it was actually more fun than the ID4, which has received praise for being fun and interesting to drive. So it sounds like this Ariya, you know, it's not like, it, you know, this boring, it's not like a Rogue or like a Nissan Murano. It's not as boring and ho-hum as some of Nissan's gasoline-powered crossovers are, which, you know, speaks to the price being a little higher. You're getting a higher quality car with a higher quality driving experience. So, and I like everything that I'm hearing from you. It looks normal, it feels a little normal, but still fun.
Yeah. Especially if you're willing to, like, you know, spend a little bit more for like the e-Force, which I think is worth it. Especially, it makes it more fun to drive. And also, you know, if you live somewhere cold, hey, all-wheel drive is a great thing. Platinum Edition is solid because you get a lot, like all the LED stuff, all the, like, the Pro Pilot assists, all the extra things you might want or need or don't want, but are there. It's a really loaded up vehicle. And I think it's interesting how mainstream automakers are starting to really load up in the, like they're making premium things like Chevy, Nissan, et cetera, that happen to just be mainstream brands, and they're $60,000 and you get all this stuff on them, you know?
So that sort of speaks to a trend that I've heard multiple automakers say, and that a lot of wealthy people don't necessarily want to, like, show off with a BMW or Mercedes-Benz badge, but they still want all the nice stuff.
Yep.
So here's your 62,000 Nissan crossover that has all that nice stuff, but doesn't have an Infiniti badge on it. There you go.
It's funny to, like, I don't know, I come at that from, that's a really interesting question too, because I've heard similar, like, thoughts from people who are like, well, hey, you know, doing pretty well, but I still want to get a Honda or something, or a Subaru, or, and like, when I think of, like, why I would want a BMW, it would be for, like, the dynamics, maybe some of the, maybe not certain models, but some of them have a more classic styling, you know, like, I like the proportions. That's why I would come at it, you know, I think, and that's why I would choose a BMW over, say, most Infinities or, like, things like that, because, like, I don't care if it's a luxury brand, but I do care that this is what I would argue the BMW brand stands for and why I might be interested in driving that car because of how it feels, you know? Like, I wouldn't just be like, oh, give me this Infiniti that I may or may not like because technically it's a luxury brand. Who the hell cares? You know, and I have that argument every time with myself, really, when I drive a Tahoe or a Suburban and I'm like, you get everything you need here. What do you need a Yukon for? You know? But, you know, and to me, the Escalade is something different entirely because it's like its own brand, you know? But we've gotten really far off topic. Let's go back to a mainstream brand, Honda Civic SI. Is this the car you drove to Indy?
It sure is. Yeah.
That's a nice road trip car.
Yeah. I drove it from Detroit to Indy. You know, I sort of came away with it, you know, with the conclusion of, for the money, it is really tough to beat this as an everyday do anything and everything car for someone who likes interesting cars, is a driving enthusiast. So I was sort of suspect of the SI when the new one came out, honestly, because they deleted a few really key things that the previous one had. Like, they got rid of the adaptive suspension. They got rid of the heated seats, just some minor luxury things that, and it also lost a little bit of horsepower, which was weird going from one generation to the next to lose power. You know, and a lot of that was to make room for the Acura Integra, because all the features that they deleted from the SI, they added to the Integra. So I was a little down about the SI, honestly.
It's a questionable move, I would argue, too, for your base.
Yeah, exactly. But I got in this SI. They ended up really, really liking it. I wasn't mad about the power. It was plenty spunky. I had it on some good roads. I took a few detours on the way back to, enjoy some interesting driving with it. And it's a lot of fun. I actually think I like driving it more than the Acura Integra. Just the base suspension tune is really, really great. It's a little stiff on the highway. You have to have some tolerance, but on a nice road, it is just where you want it to be. The transmission is just dreamy. Like, outside of a Civic Type R, you're going to be hard pressed to find a better transmission in any car at almost any price point, as far as manuals go. I like the engine a lot. it's hard to make these tiny little four-cylinder engines that are turbocharged like actually engaging and fun to drive. But the SIs is cool. It's got VTEC for the exhaust valves, and it actually pulls really hard all the way to the top of the RPM range. You get sort of rush in like the last 700 to 1,000 RPM, like right to red line, which, you know, as somebody who has older Hondas and loves that thing, you know, that's really cool to me. It's got a nice little tone, a nice sound to it. It's not loud by any means, but you know that it's obviously tuned to appeal to an enthusiast's ear. And for that road trip, it also has all the things that you might want. It's got a great Bose sound system. You know, it's not as good as like the ELS system in an Acura, but it's still pretty good. Honda gives you all of the driver assistance stuff. So I was just adaptive cruise control and lane centering the whole way down and up. You know, all you have to do is sort of keep some pressure on the steering wheel and it tracks the curves beautifully. Honda's come a long way in their driver assistance systems over time. This is one huge improvement from the previous SI to this new one. It's just so much more tractable on the daily. Overall, it's just like a really, really pleasant, nice car for the price. You know, you're looking right around $30,000. That is really nice for what you get. You get have so many niceties in there. And it's fun when you really want to push it and go, like the car will do it. And you know, the brakes hold up. The one that I had summer tires on it, grip for days. It's there. It's there right out of the box. So, if you're looking at that $30,000 price range, I don't think that there's anything that I would recommend more than an SI. Who cares that it has 5 horsepower less? It rules. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, it's still 200 horsepower. You're talking about, you know, that's a lot for it. I think it's a 1.5 liter engine. I mean, that's just a lot, you know? And again, I've always thought with the SI in particular, revs are your friend, you know, just rev that engine and have fun with the clutch. And, you know, I mean, you won't miss those 5 extra horsepower, I wouldn't think, but, it's a great value too. Starts at just under 30, to your point. So, I mean, this is the kind of car where, like, you know, you're maybe just out of college looking for something that's kind of fun to drive. You know, maybe you take out like maybe a smallish loan, you know, just to like as you're trying to get on your feet. I mean, this is the kind of car that, you know, like enthusiasts could get into it. Maybe you take like one or two of the options, you know, and try to have some fun with it there. Or maybe you're not out of college. You just want to spend 30 grand and have a fun car with a, you know, good transmission and peppy engine. And I think this is really, it's very ubiquitous for enthusiasts of all stripes.
And it's super utilitarian too. Backseat is huge. I put people in the backseat in the week that I had it. I loaded up the trunk with a suitcase and camera bag. So much space back there.
Yeah.
You know, and that again speaks to its ability to be like a do-it-all car right out of college. Or if you only have room for one car and you're on a budget, want something fun. You can do anything and everything with this car. It's so utilitarian. And you can still have fun with all your friends when you want to go driving. So, yeah.
All right. Now, you did get to do something a bit saucier. Type R on track. Were you the one behind the wheel or was this a ride along? Or
I was behind the wheel. Yeah.
And where was this, the Brickyard or the road course?
So we got, this was also down at Indy. We got shipped down to Putnam Park Road Course, which is about 45 minutes outside of Indianapolis.
Yeah.
It's this little sort of countryside racetrack that they had, man, if I had like 10 Type R's there. For us journalists to try out. Honda was really featuring and talking up their Log R system, which is their track telemetry system that they have on the cars, which is really cool, actually. You get a lot of racing overlays and analysis of all the data on track and whatnot. But, I mean, obviously, I was just super excited to be able to track a Civic Type R, which is really cool. I had had some experience on the street prior to this, but this is like a Civic filled weekend. Go from the SI to the Type R on a track, no less. Honda had them on the Michelin Pilot Sport Cup 2 tires, which are the optional tires you can get. You can buy them from the dealer. It's the tire that Honda set their Nürburgring front-wheel drive lap record on, and I can confirm that they pretty much seem to never run out of grip. You have to the limits are so high on this thing. The best way that I could describe it is it sort of feels like what a Porsche GT car would be like, but having done to a Civic is what this thing feels like on track. Which is super cool. And, so on the street, I had driven it in mostly comfort mode and sport damper, but when you get out on the track, I tried out the Plus R mode, and that is exactly where it's at home at. You can actually use that Plus R with a super stiff suspension, feel that LSD yank you through corners. It doesn't feel compromised as a front wheel drive car. I got about 10 to 12 laps out there on the road course, had a great big ball of fun. It was a lovely day. I did that and some other things that I'm about to tell you about here.
Do tell. Let's not stand on ceremony. Got a hybrid racer ride along. That's hard to say.
Man.
And some electric go-karts.
Yeah. So the CRV hybrid racer, if you guys missed that story beforehand, you should definitely go check it out. There are a lot of technical specs to go through here, but in a nutshell, this is basically a CRV hybrid body from sort of the front fascia, the rear fascia a little bit, the roof, part of the doors. But Honda did a crazy thing, and they put an IndyCar engine in it. Not only an IndyCar engine, but a sort of like a prototype testbed IndyCar engine for when Indy is eventually going to hybrid vehicles. So it has the 2.2 liter twin turbocharged V6 that we use right now in all the Honda Indy cars, but that is then mated up with an electrified portion, the skeleton supercapacitor, and obviously an electric motor, and it combines for 800 horsepower. So 800 horsepower in a Honda CR-V is pretty much as crazy as you would expect it to be.
Can imagine.
Yeah. So we got a ride along on the same track that we were driving the Type R's at. I got to ride two laps with this thing. It is fast. It is fast, obviously. It weighs about nothing. It uses a Chromoly frame from Indy. It uses NSX GT3 suspension in combination with an actual IndyCar suspension. Massive tires. The only bad thing I could say about it is that it hurt my ears when I was in it. The engine is literally, so like you're sitting in this thing, and that IndyCar engine is like just chilling right behind you. It is mid-engine, and what it basically does is it creates this reverb chamber in there that is like unbelievably loud, and sort of like it just tickles your ears to the point where it's like, oh wow. This feels like hearing damage. and I was wearing ear protection too. So this is a serious, serious race car. And Honda's actually going to be racing this thing around at a number of different tracks throughout the IndyCar season. So if you go to IndyCar races, you might be able to see it at a few of them. It is quite the hilarious machine to see it in person and then to ride in it. It is a lot to handle. So
I wonder, you think they'll have it at the Detroit Grand Prix this weekend where we both will be?
That is a good question. I would have to go do some research on that. They said that it was going to go out to like seven or eight races throughout the year. It would be cool if they had it in Michigan for the streets of Detroit. I don't know. They had it down in Indy. They didn't race it at the Speedway, but they just had it out for us to ride in at this Putnam Park road course. So we'll see. They could easily ship it up. You know, they were loading up onto a trailer as we were leaving. So should have just told them to like, hey, go ahead and take this to Detroit. Let's watch it tear up the streets. 300
miles away, you know.
It's right there. So the last thing that I did there also over at Putnam, but on a separate location, Honda had these little electric go-karts. Now, if you haven't heard of them before, I wouldn't blame you. It's not like many people would write news stories or a lot of coverage about some new electric go-karts that Honda made. But Honda set up a little autocross course for us to race them around. They're called the EGX Racing Kart Concept. So they're not production yet. These are basically concept electric go-karts that go really, really fast. they're super, super fun. They have a top speed of 45 miles per hour. There are two battery packs that are like super modular. Like you can literally just open this flap up on either side and just slide the battery pack out like it's nothing. So if you're like a go-kart racer, you could bring like a number of battery packs to the track. Like as soon as these two run out, you just pop two in and go. It literally takes like 15 seconds to swap them out. It uses a chromoly body. Like I said, 45 mile per hour top speed. And it is so much fun to drive. If you've driven like a lot of electric or gas go-karts before at like various serious like public karting venues, this was so much better than any of them that I've ever driven. The steering, the throttle response, the braking, the actual handling of like the chassis itself. This felt like a professional go-kart. And I think that some of that comes from the fact that I have not driven like a real serious like $5,000 go-kart before. And that's sort of what this is. Like, this is a very expensive go-kart. But it feels its price. It is a really, really fun thing to wheel about. And I was just chatting with other journalists there and whatnot. And, you know, we were just thinking about the end of the day and like, all right, like what was the most fun thing that you did there? And sure, the Type R on the track was a lot of fun. So was riding that CR-V hybrid, but most of us actually liked driving the go-karts more than anything else. And I
could see that.
I was of the same mind. We were sort of racing each other. So you have that whole like, oh, like what journalist is faster than another thing going on. it's not that serious though. It's all good fun. So, and that's really what these go-karts are about. And, I really hope that Honda makes them and sends them out to all these random karting venues and we can have like good karts to race with, because these electric things, they get up and go, the handling is so good. I would jump at the opportunity to drive one again.
Sounds good. I you're really selling it. I can't wait to. This sounds awesome.
Yeah, man. If Honda throws out the opportunity to drive these carts again, say yes. Okay. Absolutely right. Say yes.
Well, we'll see. That's pretty awesome. Yeah. All right. So let's spend some money. Maybe an electric go-kart. Probably not. So Wayne writes, here it is, for my 60th birthday, I'm going to buy my dream car. I have $60,000 to spend. Here's the list. 2017 to 18 Camaro ZL1, 17 to 18 Mustang GT350, the F82-83 M4 convertible, C6 Corvette Grand Sport, used Hellcat Challenger, or the C7 Z06 or BMW i8, where he'd be willing to go up to about 65 for those. Preference is kind of for an open top car. So it could be a Targa convertible, even a sunroof would qualify. Current weekend car is a 2005 Z4. Thanks. I enjoy the podcast. Signed, Wayne in Maryland. So this is a tough one. Wayne offers up like two or three different things that I strongly feel I could, you know, would be on my short list, frankly. I'll kick it over to you. What do you think?
Yeah, this is a tough one. Being able to play with $60,000 is a nice thing, because
it's a sweet spot for this.
Yeah, this list has so many good options on it. Me personally, I would go get a GT350. Mm. But it doesn't have a sunroof. You can't get it in a convertible. So you'd have to give that up. And the fact that you have a Z4 right now means you probably like having a convertible. You like being able to drive around. Open roof, open top. I get that. I recently bought a Boxster myself because that's exactly what I love. Like that's what I wanted. So if that is, you know, more overpowering than the allure of a flat plane crank V8 and an awesome manual transmission and all the beautiful things that a GT350 comes with, I would go with the Camaro ZL1 and I'd go get the convertible, because that too will be an insanely good performance car and you'll have so much fun. It'll actually probably handle just as good as the 350, if not better, because the Camaro chassis is so, so good. But if you can get one of those, get the convertible, you can have so much power with a great chassis and still keep your open roof concept. I think you're going to love that. So 350, if you want to get rid of that convertible, ZL1, if you feel like you really want it and need it, both are great options. You can't go wrong.
Yeah, no, that's half of where I landed. My first choice would be the GT350. I think that's a special car with a special engine. And I happen to think that generation of Mustang is really pitch perfect as far as design. You know, I think the car just kept getting sharper and more ripped as the 2010s rolled on. And I think that was like a really good time for it. I think I even like that look a little better than how I like the current car and the new generation, if you will, that's going to launch. So that would be my first choice. My second choice would be, I'm thinking the M4 convertible. I just, like I said earlier, what would attract me to a BMW would be all of the things it could do and the sporty ethos, the athletic heritage, that spirit of competition that BMW brings, you know, and all that history that goes back 100 years. So that's what, you know, would draw me to a BMW like this one. So those would be my first two. And, you know, the Corvettes are interesting. I drove the C6 Corvette Grand Sport. That was fun. That was cool. I think I would tend to take that over a C7 Z06 or even an i8, just because to me, the C6 is something you're going to be able to drive a little bit more and a little bit more comfortably. So I think that's where I would slot that as my third one.
Yeah. I really like the idea of the M4, honestly. That would probably be my third choice.
Yeah.
You already got a Z4. You like BMWs. Yeah. You know, maybe you want to stick in the family. Yeah. That M4 is a lot of fun.
Yeah. So, and it's a big car, too. You know, I think you might like that, if you will, as far as getting something that's a little more practical versus the Z4, which is more of like, you know, that's a true fun, you know, weekend roadster convertible type of thing. Maybe you drive it every day. But as far as just like getting something that has a lot of gravitas, you know, I don't think you would go wrong with that. So, yeah. All right. Well, it's officially summer. Memorial Day is in the rearview mirror. It's hot as hell here in Michigan. I don't know when the official summer starts. I think it's later in June, but I'm calling it summer. What are you drinking there, Zach, when you're watching IndyCar from the comfort of your couch?
Man, it was an Oberon and a Line and Kugel weekend is what it was.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just like you said, it feels like summer. And I can't think of a more summer combo than a nice crisp Oberon, honestly.
That sounds good.
And
that sounds good.
They're shipping it again, so gotta get it.
That's a good one. That's a good one. I've actually been drinking a bit of Heineken. I think just the F1 marketing is getting to me. I mean, it's, you know, you're watching Monaco and every turn is like Heineken, you know, low alcohol, Heineken zero alcohol, Heineken original. I think I really could go for a Heineken. So I don't know. That's what I've been kind of drinking. But it's hot. This is the time of the year when you kind of like some of these, you know, the beers that are a little more maybe citrusy, maybe a little bit even lighter. There's actually a Bell's, what is it? It's the IPA, the Two Hearted, but I think it's called Lighthearted.
Yes.
That's like 3.5% that I haven't tried, but I saw it the other day at the store and I think I need to pick up a sixer of that, see what that's all about. I think I might really like that.
Yeah, I saw they have a whole line of hearted beers now.
Yep.
It's like double-hearted, lighthearted, the original Two-Hearted. So I got to try the lineup.
Exactly. And I mean, they were the Bell family, I believe Bell's family sort of sold out controlling interest to, I forget who they sold it out to, but I think we were seeing is a lot of money from the new owners get poured into it. And that's like what companies do. You buy in and you really like invest in the strengths in the way that perhaps like the founders may not have. And I think, you know, if you're going to tell me there's more kinds of Bell's beer, well, that sounds good to me. You know, as a Michigander, I was a little sad to see the family-owned company kind of, you know, step back, but I think they're still involved. And Yeah, it's on the list. I may have to get a sixer of that next time I grill. I got to clean up my grill too. That's another thing. Other things have been getting ahead of that on the chore list. That's got to go to the front. So
I got to buy a grill.
You got to buy a grill. Okay. Are you going to go gas or electric?
Probably gas, honestly.
Yeah.
Just keep it. I'll go buy something used for cheap, I think, will be the option. Yeah.
That's a good move, too. I think I have an in-ground gas grill, which is awesome.
Oof,
but it's a little high maintenance. You know, like charcoal grills, you dump them. And if you ever need to buy a grate, I mean, that's like a once-a-lifetime thing for the most part. Gas grills, you got to scrape them all the time. If like the gunk gets into the like the piezo ports and the like the fire holes, if you will, it's a problem. So that's going to be, maybe I'll do that tonight because I'd like to make some, you know, some skewers or something maybe towards the end of the week. So
I love it. Maybe our next spend my money should be on grills. Sound it
could.
You know, yeah. Your way around a grill, it sounds like.
At times I fake it. That's what I would say is, you know, but I have a charcoal one too in the garage, which I'd love to use, but it's just way far in the back. And it's like so much easier just to turn a knob and the grill fires up, the gas grill fires up. So, all right. If you have a recommendation for a grill, let us know. Maybe one that's a reasonable price, something that a lot of different people might be able to get into. If you want us to spend your money, that's podcast@autoblog.com. Be safe out there, and we'll see you next week.